Good evening, and welcome to BAM, and welcome to the opening night of Eat, Drink, Be Literary in 2009. I'm Karen Brooks-Hopkins, president here at BAM. We're very happy to see everyone tonight. I just realized I mentioned to Harold Augenbraum from the National Book Award, National Book Foundation, that this is our fifth year, amazing, of this program. So how many of you have been here since the beginning? All right, great. We know that this is a very loyal audience, and we appreciate your loyalty. The authors appreciate it, and it's just been incredible that when we started, we really wanted to build a community around literature the way that BAM has in so many of the different art forms. And because of your loyalty and support of this program and coming and just being part of it, it has been amazingly successful. And most of the programs, as you know, are regularly sold out, so it's wonderful to have everyone back again. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our five-year partner in this incredible endeavor, Harold Augenbraum, Executive Director of the National Book Foundation. Thank you all.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Joe. And thank everybody for coming out on this cold night. I have one word for everybody. Florida. There aren't any writers in Florida, but, you know, we could bring Eat, Drink, and Be Literary down there. As long as you pay our transportation, we're happy to do these programs in Florida where it's a little bit warmer than it is out here. I'm really here to welcome you on behalf of the National Book Foundation and talk a little bit about literature. And so I don't think that I could let this week go by without mentioning something about politics and literature. The first thing that I would like to say is this: we've been doing this for 4 years. This is the beginning of our fifth year, and I guess I'm sad to say this is the last program we're going to be doing in Eat, Drink, and Be Literary during the Bush administration. Now, I also want to tell you that in the mail today, I got two publications from the Bush administration. One of them was about how reading, how literary reading has gone up markedly during the Bush administration. Now, for those of you who read in the New York Times yesterday this article about how reading literary fiction has just skyrocketed during the Bush administration, it was hard to believe because only 15 months ago, the Bush administration sent me a report saying that literary reading had plummeted over the last 30 years, including the time of the Bush administration, following up on the report from 2004 that said that literary reading had plummeted in the last 30 years, including the Bush administration. Now, 5 days before the end of the Bush administration, suddenly all those line graphs from 2002 to 2008 jumped up. The second publication was about the programs that the Bush administration had done to help increase literary reading in the United States, called the Big Read. So I urge you to read this report that has come out, write to the National Endowment for the Arts and ask for a copy of it to see the final optimistic part of literature and the Bush administration. And finally, I do have to say that the one thing that it makes me think of is that there should be a banner on the front of this report saying, "Mission accomplished." So let me tell you a little bit about how the night is going to go, and we'll go on from there. What we're going to do is I'm going to introduce the moderator for this evening, and then she will come up here. She will introduce our reader for this evening. They will then both leave the platform, and the technical people from BAM will make their changes here, put out the seats and all that. Then Evan and Louise will have a conversation. After that, they will open it up to questions from the audience. And then finally, Louise will be signing her books in the back near the bookstore. So let's go right on to the program. Evan Sweeney studied at Harvard University, where she won the John Harvard Scholarship and the Elizabeth Cary Agassiz Scholar Award. She has an MFA from the University of Virginia, where she studied with Debbie Eisenberg, who, if you were here for that program, was a great program. She writes reviews for major publications across the country. She's the executive director of the Center for the Humanities at the City University of New York Graduate Center, and she's also one of the founders of the new Leon Levy Center for Biography. She's also the author of the novel, among other things, I've Taken Up Smoking. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Even Sweeney.
I want to thank Harold and Leslie Shipman, who've really done wonderful things with the National Book Award, the National Book Foundation, and made this possible. And I'm really happy to be back here. It's great to see you guys, and I think you are really the people that make up the literary community that this kind of event can grow out of, and it's something to be proud of. Obviously, with the influence of people like Karen Brooks Hopkins to make it keep going. It's my particular honor tonight to introduce Louise Erdrich, whose books I feel I've actually sort of grown up on as a writer, in the sense that I first read her novels when I was actually really beginning to get serious about writing. And I remember knowing from the very first page that I would be learning from her for the rest of my life. I think no matter what age you are, when you first pick up an Erdrich novel, whether it is your first or her first or her last, or whether you were a writer or not, you will probably have this feeling that the writer and not just the reader in you is really being nurtured. And I think this feeling really comes from the fact that all of her books are narrated by so many different voices, which in spite of differing so widely in age, race, gender, and sort of cultural disposition, nevertheless, all seem to be singularly suited to telling a really gorgeous, heart-wrenching, hilarious, mythic, and profoundly moving tale. In other words, I think what you understand when you read these books is that you're reading the work of someone not only extraordinarily intelligent and artful, but deeply empathetic. You read these books, and whether you are male or female, a new reader or a studious writer, you think, if only I could listen to my neighbor think, or my grandmother think, or even myself think, I might hear something this rich and beautiful as well. And this kind of listening is unfortunately Louise Erdrich's talent and does not come so easily to the rest of us. We all have our prejudices, our excuses, our little habits that get us kind of in the way of our own listening. But luckily, we also have Louise Erdrich. In her hands, I think the stories, our mother's stories, our daughter's stories, our neighbor's stories, and even sometimes our enemies' stories, flower and bloom and together kind of weave into a thicket of history and broaden into something that is distinctly American, an epics of love and war. For those of you who have read Erdrich, you will probably have intuited that the families and neighbors she listened to from an early age were from a small town in North Dakota, like the one she often writes about, and that many were Native American. As many of you probably know, she grew up in Wahpeton, North Dakota, near the Bureau of Indian Affairs School, where her mother, of French and Ojibwe descent, and her father, who's actually of German descent, so there you go, you're fine on the herring and pretzels. They were both teachers there at the school, and she's a member and descendant of the Chippewa Nation. Her first novel, Love Medicine, set off a cycle of four more novels, including The Beat Queen, Tracks, and The Bingo Palace, which chronicle over at least a century the lives of two mixed-blood families, the Cashpaws and the Lamartines, who we've all gotten to know very well over this past decade or so. The characters from these novels resurface in consequent ones, and those of us who learned to love those families, the lovers and friends of the Lamartines and the Cashpaws, found old branches of family trees on which to perch in the new trees that spread from Tales of Burning Love, The Antelope Wife, The Last Report on the Miracles at a Little No Horse, The Master Butcher's Singing Club, and Four Souls. Painted Drum took us to New Hampshire, and her most recent novel, Plague of Doves, is back again in North Dakota. Erdrich has published poetry collections, children's books, and nonfiction, and now she has published her first collection of stories. I believe it's your first, right? Yeah. Which is The Red Convertible, which gathers together new and selected stories from the beginning of her career. For me, reading this collection was a little bit like visiting an artist's studio and seeing the tools on the bench and getting the view out the window. This is not to say that a single one of them feels unfinished, but that seeing the fresh use of the colors and tones and characters that we all grow to love over her novels was really exciting. Unlike many of her earlier books, The Red Convertible does not have a family tree as a frontispiece, but if it did, I suppose it would sort of overrun the front and back covers and even maybe run over all the covers of a lot of the American fiction we know and love. These are stories that come not only out of the woods and farms and kitchens and circuses and office parks of families they describe, but out of a literary tradition of writers from Whitman to Faulkner to Morrison, who've all shaped American letters for many centuries and will continue for centuries to come. In short, as you can see, it is my opinion that we are very lucky to be able to hear Louise Erdrich read from this collection tonight. So without further ado, I give you Louise Erdrich.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you, Harold, Karen, Leslie, and thank you, everybody, who's sitting with a glass that may or may not have some wine in it. Now, if there is any wine at your table, please pour it into your glass. It's very nice for a reader to have people with a glass of wine in their hands. It always makes me more comfortable. If the people at the next table have wine, please pass it over. You know, everybody should have the rest of this wonderful wine. And I'm very happy to read here, although I came from Minnesota thinking you were going to have it nice and warm for a person who's been wearing nothing but huge down coats so far this winter. Oh, well. It's great to be here anyway. I love being here. And I'm going to read from this book, The Red Convertible, The Coyote Behind the Wheel. My wonderful editor fought really hard for this cover. It was one of those dreams. It was a dream cover. And I had this dream. It had to be this coyote behind the wheel of the convertible. And I smile every time I see it. So it's been really... It's been really great to have this book. And this particular story, maybe we'll talk a little bit about it later, but one of the greatest thing that ever happened in literary terms to me, I think, was that this story, which is a little fantastical, was included in a high school textbook as biography. And you'll know why it was wonderful for me that this hit someone who chose for this textbook as absolute, you know, truth, because I couldn't have written a more fantastical story, I thought. So, The Leap. My mother is the surviving half of a blindfold trapeze act. Not a fact I think about much even now, that she is sightless, the result of encroaching and stubborn cataracts. She walks slowly through our house, lightly touching her way along walls and running her hands over shelves, books, the drift of a grown child's belongings and cast-offs. She has never upset an object, or so much as brushed a magazine onto the floor. She has never lost her balance or bumped into a closet door left carelessly open. The cat-like precision of her movements in old age might be the result of her early training, but she shows so little of the drama or flair one might expect from a performer that I tend to forget the flying Avalons. She has kept no sequined costume, no photographs, no flyers or posters from that part of her youth. I would, in fact, tend to think that all memory of double somersaults and heart-stopping catches has left her arms and legs were it not for the fact that sometimes, as I sit sewing in the room of the house that I slept in as a child, I hear the crackle, catch a whiff of smoke from the stove downstairs, and suddenly the room goes dark, the stitches burn beneath my fingers, and I am sewing with a needle of hot silver, a thread of fire.
I owe her my existence three times. The first was when she saved herself. In the town square, a replica tent pole, cracked and splintered, now stands cast in concrete. It commemorates the disaster that put the town on the front page of the Boston and New York tabloids. It is from those old newspapers, now historical records, that I got my information, not from Anna of the Flying Avalons, not from any of her relatives, now dead, or certainly from the other half of her particular act. Harold Avalon, her first husband. In one news account, it says, the day was mildly overcast, but nothing in the air or temperature gave any hint of the sudden force with which the deadly gale would strike. I've lived in the West, where you can see the weather coming for miles, and it is true that in town we are something of a disadvantage. When extremes of temperatures collide, a hot and cold front, winds generate instantaneously behind a hill and crash upon you without warning. That, I think, was the likely situation on that day in June. People probably commented on the pleasant air, grateful that no hot sun beat upon the striped tent that stretched over the entire center green. They bought their tickets and surrendered them in anticipation. They sat, ate caramelized popcorn and roasted peanuts. There was time before the storm for three acts. The white Arabians of Alcazar rose on their hind legs and waltzed. The mysterious Bernie folded himself into a painted cracker tin. The Lady of the Mists made herself appear and disappear in surprising places. As the clouds gathered outside unnoticed, the ringmaster cracked his whip, shouted his introduction, and pointed to the ceiling of the tent where the flying Avalons were perched. They loved to drop gracefully from nowhere, like two sparkling birds, and blow kisses as they doffed their glittering plumed helmets and high-collared capes. They laughed and flirted openly as they beat their way up again on the trapeze bars. In the final vignette of their act, they actually would kiss mid-air, pausing, almost hovering, as they swooped past each other. On the ground, between boughs, Harry Avalon would skip lightly to the front rows and point out the smear of Anna's lipstick just off the edge of his mouth. They made a romantic pair, all right, especially in the blindfold sequence. That afternoon, as the anticipation increased, as Mr. and Mrs. Avalon tied sparkling strips of cloth onto each other's faces, and as they puckered their lips in mock kisses, lips destined never to meet, as one long breathless article put it, the wind rose, only miles off, wrapped itself into a cone and howled. There came a rumble of electrical energy drowned out by the sudden roll of drums. One detail, not mentioned by the press, perhaps unknown, Anna was pregnant at the time, 7 months and hardly showing. Her stomach muscles were that strong. It seems incredible that she would work high above the ground when any fall could be so dangerous, but the explanation, I know from watching her go blind, is that my mother lives comfortably in extreme elements. She is one with the constant dark now, just as the air was her home, familiar to her, safe before the storm that afternoon. From opposite sides of the tent, they waved, blind and smiling, to the crowd below. The ringmaster removed his hat and called for silence so that the two above could concentrate. They rubbed their hands in chalky powder. Then Harry launched himself once, swung twice in huge calibrated beats across space. He hung from his knees and on the third swing stretched wide his arms, held his hands out to receive his pregnant wife as she dove from her shining bar. It was while the two were in midair, their hands about to meet, that lightning struck the main pole and sizzled down the guy wires, filling the air with a blue radiance. that Harry Avalon must certainly have seen, even through the cloth of his blindfold, as the tent buckled and the edifice toppled him forward. The swing continued and did not return in its sweep, and Harry went down, down, into the crowd, with his last thought perhaps just a prickle of surprise at his empty hands. My mother once told me I'd be amazed at how many things a person could do in the act of falling. Perhaps at that time she was teaching me to dive off the high board of the town pool, for I associate the idea with mid-air somersaults. But I also think she meant that even in that awful, doomed second, one could think. She certainly did. When her hands did not meet her husband's, my mother tore her blindfold away. As he swept past her on the wrong side, she could have grasped his ankle or the toe end of his tights and gone down clutching him, but instead, she changed direction. Her body twisted toward a heavy wire, and she managed to hang on to the braided metal, still hot from the lightning strike. Her palms were burned so terribly that once healed, they bore no lines, only the blank scar tissue of a quieter future. She was lowered gently to the sawdust ring just underneath the dome of the canvas roof, which did not entirely settle, but was held up on one end and jabbed through, torn and even on fire in places from the giant spark, though rain and men's jackets soon put that out. Three people died, but except for her hands, my mother was not seriously harmed until an overeager rescuer broke her arm in extricating her and also, in the process, collapsed a portion of the tent bearing a huge buckle that knocked her unconscious. She was taken to the local hospital, and there she must have hemorrhaged, for they kept her confined to her bed for a month and a half before her baby was born without life. Harry Avalon had always wanted to be buried in the circus cemetery next to the original Avalons, so she sent him back with her brothers. The child, however, is buried around the corner beyond this house and just down the highway. It was during her confinement in the hospital that my mother met my father. He was called in to look at the set of her arm, which was complicated, and he stayed sitting at her bedside, for he was something of an armchair traveler and had spent his war quietly at an Air Force training grounds. My mother had no family of her own and had been taken in by the Avalons, trained to perform from a very young age. They had toured Europe before the war, then based themselves in New York. She was illiterate. It was in the hospital she learned to read and write as a way of overcoming the boredom and depression of those months. And it was my father who insisted on teaching her to read. In return for stories of her adventures, he graded her first exercises. He brought her first book to her, and over her bold letters, which the pale guides of the penmanship pads could not contain, they fell in love. I wonder whether my father calculated the exchange he offered, one form of flight for another. For after that, and for as long as I can remember, my mother was never without a book. Until now, that is, and remains the greatest difficulty of her blindness. Since my father's recent death, there was no one to read to her, which was why I returned, in fact, from my failed life where the land is flat. I came home to read to my mother, to read out loud, to read long into the dark, to read all night. Once my father and mother married, they moved onto the old farm he had inherited and didn't much care for. Though he'd been thinking of moving to a larger city, he settled down and broadened his practice in this valley. It still seems odd to me that they chose to stay in the town where the disaster occurred, and which my father in the first place had found so constricting. But it was my mother who insisted on it after her child did not survive. And then, too, she loved the sagging farmhouse with its scrap of woods and hidden hay fields. I owe my existence The second time, then, to the two of them and the hospital that brought them together. That is the debt we take for granted, since none of us asks for life. It is only once we have it that we hang on so dearly. I was 7 the year that the house caught fire, probably from standing ash. It can rekindle, and my father, forgetful about the house, perpetually exhausted, often emptied what he thought were ashes from cold stoves into wooden or cardboard containers. The fire could have started from a flaming box or a buildup of creosote in the chimney. It started right around the stove, and the heart of the house was gutted. The babysitter, fallen asleep in my father's den on the first floor, woke to find the stairway to my upstairs bedroom cut off by flames. She used the phone, then ran outside to stand beneath my window. When my parents arrived, the town volunteers had drawn water from the fire pond and were spraying the outside of the house, preparing to go in after me, not knowing at the time that there was only one staircase and it was lost. On the other side of the house, the superannuated extension ladder broke in half. Perhaps the clatter of it falling against the walls woke me, for I'd been asleep up to that point. As soon as I awakened, I smelled the smoke. I did things by the letter then, and I was good at memorizing instructions. So I did exactly what was taught in the second grade home fire drill. I got up, I touched the back of my door without opening it. Finding it hot, I left it closed and stuffed my rolled up rug against the crack. I did not hide beneath my bed or crawl into my closet. I put on my flannel robe, and then I sat down to wait. Outside, my mother stood below my dark window and saw clearly that there was no rescue. Flames had pierced one side wall, and the glare of the fire lighted the mammoth limbs and trunk of the vigorous old maple that had probably been planted the year the house was built. No leaf touched the wall, and just one thin limb scraped the roof. From below, it looked as though even a squirrel would have had trouble jumping from the tree onto the house, for the breadth of that small branch was no bigger than my mother's wrist. Standing there, my mother asked my father to unzip her dress. When he treated her too gently, as if she'd lost her mind, she made him understand. He couldn't make his hands work, so she finally tore it off and stood there in her pearls and stockings. She directed one of the men to lean the broken half of the extension ladder up against the trunk of the tree. In surprise, he complied. She ascended. She vanished. Then she could be seen easily among the leafless branches of late November as she made her way up and up and along her stomach, inched the length of the bough that curved above the branch that brushed the roof. Once there, swaying, she stood and balanced. There were plenty of people in the crowd, and many who still remember, or think they do, my mother's leap through the ice-dark air toward that thinnest extension, and how she broke the branch falling so it cracked in her hands, cracked louder than the flames, as she vaulted with it toward the edge of the roof, and how it hurtled down end over end without her, and their eyes went up again to see where she had flown. I didn't see her leap through the air, only heard the sudden thump, and looked out my window. She was hanging by her heels from the new gutter we had put in that year, and she was smiling. I was not surprised to see her. She was so matter-of-fact. She tapped on the window. I remember how she did it, too. It was the friendliest tap, a bit tentative, as if she was afraid she'd arrived too early at a friend's house. Then she gestured at the latch, and when I opened the window, she told me to raise it wider, prop it open with a stick so it wouldn't crush her fingers. She swung down, caught the ledge, and crawled through the opening. Once she was in my room, I realized she had on only underclothing, a tight bra of the heavy circular stitched cotton women used to wear, and step-in lace-trimmed drawers. I remember feeling lightheaded, of course, terribly relieved and then embarrassed for her to be seen by the crowd undressed. I was still embarrassed as we flew out the window toward Earth, me in her lap, her toes pointed as we skimmed toward the painted target of the firefighter's tarp held below. I know that she's right. I knew it even then. As you fall, there is time to think. Curled as I was against her stomach, I was not startled by the cries of the crowd or the looming faces. The wind roared and beat its hot breath at our back. The flames whistled. I slowly wondered what would happen if we missed the circle or bounced out of it. Then I forgot fear. I wrapped my hands around my mother's hands. I felt the brush of her lips, and I heard the beat of her heart in my ears, loud as thunder, long as the roll of drums. Thanks.
Thank you.
So that was a really beautiful story. There you have it. An artist. A very skillful one. And you can totally understand why they would have included it in a textbook on biography, because she has a way of making everything absolutely real. And I have to just include you in a little anecdote. When we first sat down and you guys were waiting in line for dinner, and we were chatting, and I brought up the fact of that plane that just plunged into the Hudson this afternoon, which I thought kind of, in a way, came out of an Erdrich story. It's just so spectacular. And immediately she said, well, yeah, I was thinking that the pilot must have been really skilled to have done such an amazing water landing. And I thought, actually, that's absolutely not what I would have been thinking about. I would have been thinking about this weird sunken plane over on 42nd Street, just the image of the plane kind of bobbing there in the water. Mm-hmm. But she's thinking about the pilot and exactly what he went through, which is, I think, really instructive about possibly the way she works. So I just want to say that. But I also said to her when she told me that she's reading The Leap, that I was thinking, oh, which book is that in? Because when you're reading this collection of stories, one of the pleasures is kind of remembering in your mind when you remember the novel that you read the story in. And I immediately connected it wrongly, actually, to Delphine, who's in the Master Butcher's Singing Club, and she's actually an acrobat, or she's kind of, well, not married, but hooked up with an acrobat,
exactly.
And they together have a balancing act. So we agreed that, in fact, balancing acts are one of the tropes that she often uses in her books, which also makes sense as a writer. But I also just wanted to ask her a little bit more about that character and where you could tell me a little bit more about where she came from.
Well, I think balancing acts really are a great trope for mothers. And that, you know, it does appear over and over, but also the theme of rescue is a continual one in all of the books. And I think that I have that mother instinct that one has where you dream that you've left your child in a suitcase and the suitcase is, you know, it's being hauled on to the plane or it's going around and you don't know which suit. You know, all those dreams that you have, or you have them. I have all these anxiety dreams. So I think a lot of the stories about the rescue come out of trying to actually, you know, in fantasy, be that kind of rescuing mother. But also we were talking about my own grandmother was part of a balancing act. She ran away from her Iowa home to be in a little circus that traveled throughout the Midwest. And when she was maybe in her 70s, I found this little picture of a woman with a tottering, teetering stack of chairs on her stomach. I mean, there was like a tray, and the chairs went up from there, and there was a man standing on his hands at the top.
Oh, so that's the trick that Delphine actually does. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a real trick.
Yeah, yeah.
It is.
That's very cool.
So maybe that's why they thought everything was biography.
Yeah.
You know, because some things are, and it's totally astonishing that that would be a true fact.
Yeah, I think you've written somewhere that the true facts actually are the most fantastic parts of your stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is totally believable. You also wrote in the preface to this collection that that you always believe that your stories are finished, but that eventually you find out that they're just not finished with you, and that you're drawn back into them. And I'm wondering, you know, in stories like this one and others with Delphine in them, and all these characters that we see over and over again, what exactly the process is of sort of drawing you in, and whether or not these characters are kind of haunting you, appearing again, whether you have to read these stories again to make them, put them in motion towards a novel, or, you know, sort of how they begin to grow.
You know, I wish I knew exactly what was happening to me. I don't really know what I'm doing. I mean, I get to the point where I think, these people resemble each other, and I keep writing about the same person. Maybe I should give that person the same name. After years go by, some of the stories in the last book were from 20 years before, and they connected with something much later. And I suppose it's having a kind of, you know, jumbled unconscious that sorts itself out very slowly over time. Mm-hmm. And then I begin to realize that, oh, these are gathering into some sort of larger narrative. Mm-hmm. And once they gather into the larger narrative and I can see the arc of it, then I say, oh, it's a novel. And then I immediately know the title, because the title's been sitting there all along. I really write to titles. That's the main metaphor for the rest of the, you know, the book will all fall into the title as if into, you know, a strong gravitational pull. That title will draw the rest of the book in.
That's interesting. So the characters that you're recognizing as you sort of piece them together in the different writing you do aren't actually necessarily driving the story, but this larger arc is, you're saying?
Yes, that I usually haven't detected until the last. Books come together very slowly on one hand, that there's pieces that I keep writing, and then about 2 years' time, I begin to not write stories anymore, mm-hmm. but chapters that make the larger arc appear.
And are those in new drafts, or are those just pulling everything together? And
those are more of they're pulling everything in. So then the stories change, and then they kind of settle into the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm. I also read in an interview somewhere that you said that you felt like you had used up a lot of the kind of emotion of your childhood experiences, and that these days it takes a lot more kind of solitude and in a way discipline to evoke these stories. But I wondered, in putting together something like this collection, which you've never done, and piecing back together these things that have come at you over your career, if they bring back these memories, or if these memories are kind of drawn out and in a way used up, as you said.
Well, you know, I realized I hadn't done the thing that most writers really do, which is start using like your adult experiences. So now I've got that to do. I haven't really thought about it.
Yeah.
But because my childhood was so powerful, really, for me, and I had such a sheltered but free very unfettered sort of childhood because I was very safe and I lived in a little town. It was on the edge of a very vast prairie, and I could go anywhere at any time of the day. You know, I could go out in the middle of the night and sleep in the football field, and I did. You know, I did. I did things like that, and you know, it was a great childhood. So it took me a long time to get through that.
Through everything it had given you.
It has given me so much.
Yeah. You also, I know you run a bookstore,
yes.
And you have an actual confessional booth that you salvaged in your bookstore. Is that right?
It's now a forgiveness booth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Because I was going to ask you what you think the role of confession is in writing and what that has to do with those childhood mm-hmm. experiences, but maybe you could also add sort of about something about forgiveness, which I feel a lot of your books are about that, forgiveness.
Well, it's all about absolution, I guess, you know, and that's why the confessional appealed to me so much. But you know, I loved it when I saw it, and I was trying to put this bookstore together out of salvage, and this was going to be a sound bar and a booth, and I thought, it should really be in the bookstore. My mother, who's a devout Catholic, thought that we should sell only books with one of the seven deadly sins in the title. Well, I can only think of lust for life. I mean, if you can think of others, and you know, I didn't know how long that was going to. So,
I think another way that I kind of see you writing is this idea that I think it's a line in one of your stories, the story that starts the Beat Queen, about the two children on the railway car, and then they split up. And at the end of the story, the line is, "It is opposites that finally meet." And I think that a lot of times your stories do have that kind of feeling of satisfaction, these kind of impossible opposites or oppositional forces that kind of come together. And I wonder if when you're writing, you actually look, most succinctly anyway, to me, for the point of view that's the opposite of the one you're expressing. It always seems to me that you're going along in one of your stories, like the one you told tonight, for instance, where you're with the mother, and then suddenly you're with the child, and you're always covering sort of absolutely both ends of the spectrum. And I wonder if you look to think about that other opposite as you're writing the first.
I think it just, you know, as I said, I don't have a lot of conscious control over what I do at all, but I. In the writing, I think, especially in these stories so far, the voice really takes over. And sometimes the voice shifts from one point of view to the other in a single story, or the interior of one character becomes as important, you know, as the other. And, you know, I really, the discipline that I have is to sit there and listen for the voice, and that's the main discipline I have to adhere to. I can't just wander around in my life and expect it to hit me. I have to wait for it and think about it and be there. So I keep as regular hours as I possibly can in my writing room or whatever it is.
Yeah. I'm just going to ask you one more question. We were talking before about kind of influences and not reading fiction while you're writing fiction, mm-hmm. But you did say you read some poetry, and I'm curious about who those poets are, and then also if you just might say a little bit about, I mean, a lot of people kind of credit you with being influenced, I think credit, being influenced by people like Faulkner, and I know you've spoken about Morrison, but people who, actual fiction writers who have opened you up in your own work, and you know, I'm curious about when that happens for you and how.
Wow, that's a long question.
I know
where to go back to.
You can maybe just start with the poets, and then we'll...
The poets.
Yeah,
I like Adam Zagajewski very much. Now, I don't know tell me how to say her name. Witsawa Szymborska.
Szymborska.
I love Robert Bly's Ghazal poems, and I love his work that he's doing now. Mahmoud Darwish.
Darwish.
I like Sharon Olds. I just have stacks that I keep going through. Pat Hampel, Trish Hampel. It's hard to really come up with them.
Yeah.
They're just
now that you've come up with a lot.
I read John Donne over and over, and there's some poets I love to.
That's interesting because he loves balancing acts so much, actually, mm-hmm. John Donne, yeah. All right, well, I can't hog any more time, and I imagine that you guys have some questions, too. So I'm turning it over to you guys. Yes, sir.
Is there something in the air that brings these outrageous or fantastical stories into existence? Is it just the upper Midwest? Is it the winters? Is it the cold, cruel, bleak winters? I don't know. I just don't know. But it does seem that there's a lot of adventure in my own particular family. So I've been lucky that way. And I don't know about Garrison Keillor's family. They seem like upright Lutherans.
That's right.
Nobody really is.
Over in the back there.
Have any of my children become circus performers?
Good for you.
Not yet. Not yet. But there's one that looks like she might be. She might be there. She's my 8-year-old. Again, I wish I had. This is about story. Are they story? And they all fit. Usually, there's 4 or 5 stories that seem to hold some sort of narrative within them. There's some repeat of theme. There's some character that seems to have developed in time. So then, as soon as I realize that I really have, in every case, tried to write a short story collection. And then I realize, no, this is all of a piece. And then I write chapters. Then for about 2 years, I'm just writing chapters. I'm not writing stories anymore. I also write children's books or middle reader books. And it actually started because I was telling stories, trying to tell stories to my daughters when they're about 8 or 9. And then I started, these books I'm working on are sort of the anti Little House in the Prairie sort of thing. Then I began to keep working on them because my mother really liked them. And, do I like working on them? I do like working on them, but it takes, I have to completely turn myself into a different type of writer. And as long as I do have children the age of, the children who will read these books, it seems pretty doable. I don't know how long. I wanted to write 8 or 10, but I'm not sure if I can, I'm going to keep going with them. And I do the drawings, too, which is also another. I do all the illustrations, and, it takes a lot of time. It takes as much time as a grown-up book and a lot of concentration. I do more research for them sometimes. Well, I think there is something about extended families in, like, my mother's side of the family. Everybody on this reservation is basically, we're all related, even though we've married into other families, as I said, my father's German, but yet I'm related to all these other people, to hundreds and hundreds of people. And I don't really keep them straight in my head. And you just greet people and say, you know, hello cousin. You're cousins with so many people. And so when I started writing, I thought, well, it will be easy because people will just not care who, you know, the exact relationships, because that's how I was. I didn't really, and I think a lot of people are like that, but then I started feeling very guilty because I would be at these readings or signings and people would come up with these torturously constructed genealogies, which, you know, I felt like, oh God, you know, everybody was doing it over and over, and I finally capitulated and had them published on the inside of the jackets. So this is the first one without a genealogy, I think. You know, I think.
I have to say, for me, that I found it really gratifying that you did that, because some of the confusion is I think gratifying for people who are in relationships where they have adopted children or non-biological parents, and those are all very much taken into account in all your families, and it's a very generous way of thinking about family, which is really nice. So,
has it changed? You know, okay. You know, I didn't think of it as, I think as a writer, you don't label your own work. And that book just, all the characters picked me because they were part of my inner life somehow. And because that was my experience. You know, I grew up on in a small town, and a reservation was part of my family, and I also was part, you know, worked in my grandfather's butcher shop. You know, I had this very rich, interesting life. And so anything I wrote about, I mean, you know, I also have this, you know, I get letters from the German-American group who see the, you know, works as German-American or whatever. You know, it doesn't really resonate for me as a writer to be any particular thing. But because many people haven't read about Native American experiences, I think it was new, interesting, and so a wonderful thing happened, which was that many more Native American writers started to write and publish. So now we have the Native American writing really is tribal writing. You know, we have Laguna Pueblo, we have Leslie Silco, we have, you know, different tribes, tribal people who are writing, and Sherman Alexie, you know, and so there isn't a whole Native American experience, it's more of a tribal experience, and I think we're getting a wonderful view of what it is to be Native in the country, but tribe by tribe. Does that make sense?
That's great.
Yeah.
So I'm being called to stop, but Louise Erdrich is going to be signing books in the back, and you can ask her questions then. And thank you so much. It was really
thank you. Nice. Thanks.